What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to the Elder Scrolls podcast. I'm Scott here with Michael and Drew, as always, and today we are finally talking about the Dunmer, the Dark Elves.
It's going to be a short one, yeah, I think. There's just not really a little one to talk about.
Well, mostly me and Drew talking.
As a preface, we have done a whole episode on the Great Houses already, so we've gone more in depth to their sort of like, you know, cultural specifics, and we also have covered and will cover, if we haven't, the certain, you know, Good Daedra or the Tribunal more specifically. So we'll go over them, but there's lots. This is more dedicated to things that more generally apply to the Dunmer, their core cultural concepts and so on, and things like
talking a lot about, say, Vivec definitely isn't going to happen because there's hours worth of individual lore related to him. So we'll try and avoid him where he's not active, where it's not actively referencing the Dunmer as a whole.
Yeah. So, do we want to start at the beginning? Because everyone knows.
I suppose we should, right? Like, as much as that's, yeah, I suppose we should.
So you've got the elves on Somerset. They're all kind of collectively the Aldmer. This is before you've got all the variations that later inhabit Greater Tamriel. And at the top of this, Auriel and Trinimac kind of are they're the figure pieces that all of the elves look up to. But then the Kaima are the changed ones under Prophet Veloth, who travel across to Rezdane, which was no accident. It was all because Boethia and potentially Mephala betrayed Trinimac and tried to show this group of gathered elves the truth. The triangle truth, as they call it. So what Boethia did was, you know, this could be partially mythology or it could be factual, but Boethia essentially spoke in Trinimac's voice and then betrayed Trinimac, swallowed him whole, crapped him out. We've been through this
many times.
But essentially, you know, you get the orcs from that because they stay true to Trinimac's deformed form. And you've got the Kaima who follow this brilliant Boethia who has just kind of shown everyone that the gods aren't quite as strong as they act. And yeah. So then they travel across to Greater Tamriel and become the Kaima.
Yeah, and so the Kaima are basically, like, biologically very similar to High Elves. Like, they looked quite similar, the height and everything like that, and the sort of goldish, kind of yellowish toned skins. But when they get to Rezdane, we've got a long bit of time before they become the Dunmer, because the actual dark-skinned elves that you see are an evolution of them. But when we first start off, you have what they call high Velothi culture in the Merethic era, which is when, you know, the Velothi, which sometimes uses a catch-all term for the Kaima, followers of Veloth, that's when you sort of have them building what they call responsible architecture, which is like the Daedric ruins and stuff that you'll see, all the dilapidated Daedric ruins. And also later the sort of some of the other Kaima architecture that's there, like the ancient tombs and ruins. But these were all created by the Kaima at these times. And the culture is seen as a high Velothi culture. So you kind of get the idea that it is a more sophisticated culture. But over time, they do actually end up sort of collapsing a bit and falling down into smaller clans and smaller tribal kind of groups, living more similar to what you would see with the Ashlanders, which is a group which are now sort of an outcast group of, at the time of the Third Era, of the Dunmer, and that they stick to their sort of Gold Daedra traditions and so on, as opposed to the Tribunal. But everyone back in those days, in the time of Nerevar, were much more like the Ashlanders of that time, especially in terms of faith, which is believing the triangle truth, the three Good Daedra, Boethia, Zura, and Mephala.
And Mephala, yeah. And well, that's one thing that makes them so unique and allowed them to manifest the way we see them manifest. But in those early days when the Kaima arrived in Rezdane, there really were no, like, the rules were completely different to whatever they knew back on Somerset. And under these Good Daedra, their teachings is what allowed them to develop this culture. And the fact that they ended up splitting off into houses that were kind of like, they worked alongside each other, but they also opposed to each other. This very much came from Mephala's idea of kind of like implanting the ideas of, you know, political machinations that might be kind of sleazy and behind the scenes and assassinating your competitors and things like this. Yeah, probably wasn't there when they were more unified in Somerset.
One of the fundamental differences that Veloth had was Somerset society at the time was really starting to revere the Aedra specifically, and only the oldest and greatest of ancestors, instead of just kind of more broadly all of your ancestors. And that kind of changed when they went to Rezdane, and you have the Khymer who preserved basically the ancestor worship of their family and clans. And clans and, you know, basically houses are essential to Dunmer society. But obviously it's kind of like more, I guess, decentralized in a way. You don't have this sort of just one high elf king of all the nobles, lords, and this strict sort of hierarchy. You just have lots of little hierarchies around the place that all interact and fight, until much later when you have, like, once again, that sort of tribunal that kind of centralizes things somewhat.
And so they have the ability to call upon a family member as well for advice because of that, which yeah. I think is quite useful. I think I've heard as well, it was when we were talking about necromancy and whether or not it's evil, because in a way, while they wouldn't consider it necromancy, it kind of is a form, but it's almost like the spirit or the soul of their ancestor would voluntarily be happy to come back and talk to them. Even if it is distressful to do so, because that's their culture.
Yeah.
And so they're happy
like,
to
yeah,
come
it's
back.
It's like a spiritual communal practice as opposed to disturbing.
I forgot exactly the phrasing, but I know that they have, like, it's often in Dunmer houses, they're supposed to be little
like
spirit
alcove
shrines.
Things.
Alcoves, that's the word. Yeah, that are dedicated to their ancestors.
And you see that with the ghost fence as well in Morrowind, that they actually kind of can become a part of to strengthen that barrier, almost like a honorable
Because, like,
sacrifice.
Small individual ghost fences were pure, like, commonplace long before the need to cordon off Red Mountain. It was just, you know, some spirits after death would protect their family's area of the crypt or whatever else. And then obviously with what happens at Red Mountain, which we'll get to soon, the need for a big communal ghost fence comes
in. In order to accelerate the story, we can go, so the Khymer are all set up. There's lots of different little smaller houses, but among them there are also greater houses. Indor and Erevar unites a bunch of them and then teams up with the Dwemer to cast out their Nord oppressors, because the Nordic kingdoms had expanded into Morrowind and were sort of controlling it in the first era. They basically get kicked out. Stuff goes on there. You've heard the story of Red Mountain before, you know, Dwemer trying to build a big god for themselves using the Heart of Lorcan. Nerevar's side, they're like, that's profane, don't do it. Nerevar dies, don't know exactly how. The conventional idea is that, you know, he died in, like, battle against Khaganak and so on. And for being super good and powerful, the Three Tribunal ascended to godhood. But we know that's them taking the Heart of Lorcan and so on. But what happens in that moment, the Azura made... Nerevar was Azura's champion. Indor or Nerevar was Azura's, like, favored champion. And in betraying the words of Nerevar, Azura gets really mad at the tribunal for abusing the power of the heart and going against Nerevar's words. And so she curses the entire race with ash skin and red eyes, sort of like, you know, like Red Mountain's territory itself. So this is actually where you have the formation of the Dunmer. And you may notice that, like, Almalexia, for example, completely neglects that because she's unaffected by it, because she's got her own godly powers and so on. So she looks like what a Khymer would have back in the day. And on the other hand, you've kind of got Sothisil, who goes full dark elf, and then you've got Vivek in the middle, who preserves half of each skin and eye type. But this really is, it's funny because Dunmer culture really starts with the tribunal and their teachings.
Yeah, like
so
if you look at the timeline, the tribunal were ruling for, I suppose, most of it. You know, so when you think about dark elf culture, it's easy to just think, you know, and obviously it is because of the Khymer, but Azura, Boethia, Mephala, but it was very much the tribunal, you know, being aspects of them that were leading the Dunmer through a kind of golden age. But then, of course, there's all the different philosophical takes on how that wasn't really involved with their whole idea of adversity and transcendence through, you know, overcoming challenges, and things were too good and too easy. And as we know now, the Dark Elves aren't in the best spot. And it seems like they'll have to go through some adversity again and refine their strength. And perhaps as unlikely as it may seem, come to a new golden age. One thing before you chime in there, Scott, that I wanted to say was it's interesting how Azura, a Daedric prince, decided to curse them with an aesthetic change. Like, it's not the craziest curse.
I think I have an answer for that, actually.
Because she's vain. She's like...
Well, there's something that goes a layer deeper, which I don't want to go on too much of a tangent with because I want to make this a video. Okay. But it's not just the fact that the Tribunal took the power, because the Dunmer, at their core, are the opposite of what the Khymer were created for. So the Khymer changed physically from the Oldmer because Boethia created them as a tribute to Lorcan. And by betraying Lorcan, they needed to make a statement that they were completely gone astray.
That's an interesting theory.
There's mention that Nerevar is the son of Boethia, one of the strongest Padamaics. And I think we've talked about it before. Like, it's an interesting statement. Like, why the son of Boethia? But then there's a few quotes. I'll just drop a couple here. But the idea is that Boethia was, like, in love with Lorcan because Lorcan was kind of like... Lorcan was the original betrayer and betrayed, and a lot of like plots and betrayal is Boethia's sphere. And there's a line from Sermon 10 which says, "We pledge ourselves to you, the frame maker, the scarab, a world for us to love you in, a cloak of dirt to cherish, betrayed by your ancestors when you were not even looking." And then another one from the Changed Ones, "They even took the missing god's name in vain, calling his narratives into question." So everything about the Khymer was kind of created by Boethia for Lorcan. And I think they went to Rhaesdane to protect Lorcan's heart. That was their purpose. Mm. That's why it was Rhaesdane. It's the most Padamaic place in Tamriel. And they betrayed it. So they needed to be punished.
Yeah.
And it to be really clear.
Yeah.
So I think I don't know if I've articulated that well in summary.
That is a pretty cool theory. But I guess it comes back to, again, regardless of the reason for their punishment, it is interesting that it wasn't more severe. Like, it's kind of just like, your skin will be blue and your eyes will be red. Like,
in ways too, though, they do have, the Nerevarine prophecy sort of ensures that this demise will happen. Like, you know, Azura says this to the Tribunal when they do it, and it obviously does come to fruition at the end of the Third Era. And they all lose. But
and the Ashlanders are the ones basically who stayed true to that.
Yeah, so the Ashlanders are probably the best example of encapsulating Khymer culture. And then just basically straight since the First Era, they've basically been the same. But what happens is when you have the Tribunal, they come in, they position themselves, once they've got this godlike power, they come before the Dunmer people and they're like, you know, take pride in your new skin and change it, so on. And like, you know, it's a new time. And that the gods of old, the good Daedra and so on, were mere anticipations of us, the more civilized sort of, basically kind of a holier form, like, you know, and they also are invested in the plights of their people because they are their people. So they are these brand new gods. So they sort of position themselves as kind of ascended forms and less brutal forms of Mephala, Boethia and Azura, respectively. So you sort of have, there's Sothasil, Azura, Mephala, Vivek and Almalexia, Boethia all being those opposites. So they fulfill these new roles. But that's another thing that's important and is a big centerpiece of Dunmer society for a long time is they are religious zealots. Like they've got living gods amongst them and this shapes their entire culture and the faith within them. And you have all of these, you know, the Tribunal Temple and, you know, lots of, Stockholm Syndrome, the word I'm using. Basically lots of dogma and...
It'd be hard like not to. Yeah. I mean, think about how long they ruled for. Even your ancestors, you know, could have worshipped the Tribunal.
Mm, absolutely.
And would have lived under them. It would be, you know, what your ancestors know. You call up the ghost of your ancestor, like we were talking about, and they tell you, yeah, the Tribunal are good.
Because there's no doubt that there's like a cult of personality kind of spawns out of it, no matter how benevolent they may be. Like, you know, Vivek keeping Bardal suspended above the city as a reminder to everyone that, you know, they owe so much to him. And that stuff is really negative, and the good Daedra and the Ashlanders would tell you that. But at the same time, thanks to having living gods who could, you know, Scott, you just said, they can kind of listen to their people and protect their interests live, you know, by negotiating with Tiber Septim and things like that, led to Morrowind being relatively impenetrable for a long time until other problems arose that kind of distracted them.
Because remember, like, the only reason they ever signed the armistice was a preemptive decision because the Heart of Lorcan was kept from them, and they was Dagoth had returned and sort of taken the heart and secured it, and they knew they couldn't go back to renew their powers, and so they knew their powers were going to fade. So they strategically, like, when Tiber Septim came to invade, they're like, yeah, okay, you know, we'll sign the armistice, but under far more favorable conditions, which allow them to keep many things like slavery and their ancient customs, and no one's going to get in there and, you know, because, you know, they're basically all Daedra worshippers in some capacity. Like, I know there's the living gods above them, but the Daedra still play a big part in their theology. So, and that's not really congruent with the rest of the Empire's sort of beliefs. But it's just interesting that, that religion plays such a central role for them, because arguably, you know, amongst, say, the Nords or the Red Guards or so on, the mythology is more so to give character and culture and meaning to things rather than necessarily instruct your daily life as much as it does. Like, there's a video on the channel about the Ordinators, who are the basically, like, you know, holy guardians of the temple, and they all wear the visage of Nerevar, and they have these complex ceremonies and how they, like, you know, bathe themselves and scrub in this specific way and the exact way they dress, and everything is very ceremonial and ornate with the peak of Dunmer society.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, that is an unusual thing about Dunmer society in general, which, to be honest, almost all of it is extremely unusual and alien to the other races and cultures. But you have these elements of their culture that are considered, like, you know, really grandiose and you know, it seems very dogmatic, I guess I'm trying to find the right word for it. But then you have these elements that other cultures would consider to be very barbaric, you know, like slavery, obviously, and then having assassination ingrained into your political system with the Morag Tong. And
I was just going to say that when the Tribunal came in, the great houses were already so established and big in power that they weren't just going to come and wipe them all out. So that's how you get the sort of Redoran and Telvanni and Lalu and so on, all having power in some capacity. And the sort of the gods want to preserve that somewhat, and the Morag Tong, like, you know, has since, even before them, been used as an intermediary for, like, clan wars, which would just destroy clans, and you'd have this constant warfare is not good for anyone, and it can just completely destroy certain houses. But in a way that the legalization of assassination and the sort of cultural understanding of the Morag Tong has allowed them to preserve for so long.
It does sound pretty cool, but I can imagine it being abused to the extent to which it wouldn't really matter. Like, you legally assassinated our king, well, we legally assassinate yours, and, like, you know what I mean? And they go back and forth assassinating important figures from...
There's a lot of potential for corruption
who's in charge of the writs, who gets to say what's approved and what isn't.
Yeah, the one thing I think that can change a little is just because they do have, like, living gods that can... you know, control them all, you know what I mean? They live in the religious fear of that he's a god that can literally, if you abuse it too much. But to actually point out of the houses, the one that has the most cultural impact and the one that's most tied with the religion is most definitely House Indoril. And they, ever since the Tribunal's emergence, have been the dominant political force in Morrowind. So they influence everything else. I'd say probably... things like traditionally Redoran has been secondary with their military roles on the western part that border where they share with Skyrim, and the, you know, they've got, like, similar kind of values of duty, piety and honor and such, and so religion is an important part to them as well.
But being ornate is not.
Yeah, well, in different ways, I guess they're using a bit more rustic, I guess, like.
Well, I mean, like, their values are, like, very practical. And they don't want to adorn their infrastructure and architecture with things that they don't need to have.
Mm.
You know, it's very, like, be sensible and strong.
Yeah, yeah.
And things like
that. It's interesting because, like, also the perspectives of what they would call sensible and strong. Because, like, even bone mold... because bone mold is, like, crushed bone and then sealed in a resin in a particular shape. Like, they don't have to choose these insectoid kind of shapes, but they
it's all reference range.
Yeah,
right? Like,
yeah, but I guess they don't have lots of gold, you know. They're not, like, bling. They don't have the bling. They have artistic takes but not bling. Yeah.
I specifically like that House Redoran of all houses chooses the kind of chitinous, like crab-like architecture. Mm. And you know, in Alderaan, you've got the shell of the Emperor Crab Scar, and it kind of like as a the house that's most closely associated with like a warrior culture and strength. They have, you know, one of their major buildings, pieces of infrastructure is the hollowed out corpse of one of their greatest enemies ever. Yeah. It just it very much suits them. But, you know, and also on House Indoril, they're definitely a bit OP when they've got one of the living gods kind of who comes from their house and represents their house. Yeah. Yeah. Even if they have to try to be a bit, even if Almalexia has to try to be a bit impartial.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so faith is a central point for the Dunmer. And then you have the Ashlanders, which, I mean, it's also important to them, but in different ways they exist as the older Kaima. But and as we've kind of discussed too, like each, you kind of get more diversity amongst the people in Morrowind. Interestingly, since they live under a centralized like god government, but they actually have more diversity amongst them compared in terms of, you know, in terms of cultural values, architecture, aesthetics, by comparison to say Skyrim or something next door, which don't try to be, you know, more diverse or any, or do you know what I mean? Like it's just kind of, it's kind of strange in that way. Like the difference between Eastmarch and Hafengar or something is nowhere near as large as the difference between the mushroom towers of the Telvanni and the crab houses of
I think it's just more effort to cool world building when Morrowind was made, to be honest. Because I was thinking that myself, when you actually look at all the different houses and all the different landscapes in Morrowind, there is just so much diversity. The difference between House Telvanni, like you were saying, and House Redoran is huge.
Mm,
it's also interesting to imagine a Kaima in a mushroom tower. Because I'm so used to associating visually the, you know, the dark elf skin with that scenery.
Oh, true. And just quickly, we should also mention that House Telvanni and Hlaalu and so on are the great houses. There are other smaller houses that have existed before. And then sometimes you can imagine it's like they cannibalize others. But at the same time, while you might have a family that's part of House Redoran, they also might be like the Sarethi clan within it, and they have their own burial, their own catacombs and so on, where they visit their ancestors and stuff like that. So it's families within families, really, when it comes to the Redoran. Obviously, there's the main branch that run the whole show.
Kind of like your ideas of having individual lords and then the liege lord that you know, that everyone rally behind,
and then,
in times
and
of
then
war.
All their governance totally happens with this sort of, each basically house has a council, and then there's also a big grand council which has members from each of the houses and so on that all sort of assemble, but then they're kind of also working alongside the word of the tribunal and the tribunal temple, which has lots of sway, obviously.
Hmm. If you wanted to talk about interesting theories, Drew, I had this idea today about Sotha Sil, who, his whole family, and that's, I'm thinking of this because you said there were other houses that were either cannibalized or destroyed, and there was this House Sotha, and basically Mehrunes Dagon came and just wiped it out, and we don't really know why he did it, but it would be interesting to consider if it was part of some kind of butterfly effect series of events that he knew he basically had to rip away all of his family and things, have him saved by Vivek, and then he would later go on you know, get all wrapped up in the tribunal and then go on to start or build the Clockwork City, which he actually calls, I'm just looking for the quote here, but he says like he viewed Nirn basically as a flawed Aedric creation. And he wanted, Sotha Sil wanted to perfect that. He wanted to like reshape the world, which is something that fits pretty well into Dagon's sphere. Though he also wanted to get rid of the Daedra, but if Dagon had some kind of foresight, it's just interesting to consider.
Well, you know, the whole gods experience time differently.
That's what I mean. And like having been through different Kalpa cycles and,
or even wanting to kind of somehow preempt his rise to power and knock it out before it happens. Who knows? But that, it is an interesting story of Sotha Sil.
Also,
and his
tiny house. Little the tad of information there too is that when you said House Sotha, for people who don't know, it was ancient Kaima tradition, but it sort of changed also just because inconsistent game reasons. But the house name goes first. So it's Indoril Nerevar or Indoril Almalexia. Mm-hmm. Like Nerevar actually married into House Indoril. So that's why it's House Sothar and Sothar Sil. So really in the way it's kind of reversing.
His name is Sil.
Yeah, it, pretty much, yeah. Mm. So that's a little fun fact for you.
Yeah, I mean, there were other houses, like even House Dwemer.
Yeah,
was
yeah,
like kind of like recognized as a house.
It's kind of an honorary position, if I can say that word. Perhaps, yeah, as a yeah. way to kind of like sate them.
You can
I guess,
see, kind of like being a clan friend of the Ashlanders. You can be a clan friend. You're not part of the clan, but you're a ally of the clan, and we won't mess with you. Or
you can see why people think the Dwemer did come from the Kaima, though, because there were so many, you know, there's thousands and thousands of years for that split to happen, theoretically, you know, of the Merethic era, of the High Elven times, and you have the High Velothi culture there. You've got this whole culture that comes there, gets established, grows, then breaks down, and then there's tribal sort of Kaima and so on, and they're sort of building back up, and at that same time, you have the Dwemer that are there. But it's kind of like, well, if the Dwemer were there the entire time, would they not have interaction sooner, or would they not have easily kind of dominated these tribal sort of Kaima and so on? It's why they believe that there could be them emerging out of a similar sort of strain, like that they were a
it could just be them. It could just be ego as well. If you were chilling underground with all your powerful technology, you have no desires to be on the surface, and then a bunch of tribals come through, you're like, okay, tribals,
but it's not tribal. But they weren't tribals at first, because at first they sort of established this High Velothi culture, which is all these, you know, all the Daedric ruins and architecture and stuff. So it's kind of like, where were they?
Couldn't you see that still being unintimidating though to the Dwemer?
But remember, the Dwemer also got conquered by, like, the Nords, for example. The Dwemer aren't some superpower. That's the one thing people, I think, when in the lore, the Dwemer are historically, like, people overblow how powerful they are. They are powerful, but are everyone else.
Yeah, but they should be. I think sometimes it feels a little bit like the Institute in Fallout 4, where it's like, they should be quite overpowered.
But
why? Well, look at dwarven spheres, like these automaton robots that come in. They wouldn't feel any pain. They're powered by these.
Yeah, but you can melt them with fireballs and stuff that have magic. Is far more. The one reason people go in so hard for the Dwemer is because of the Numidium and Heart of Lorcan stuff, which doesn't even happen until the First Era.
That and there's also the calling devices and stuff, like
yeah, tonal architecture, telekinesis. Yeah, for sure.
Tonal
advanced.
Architecture is the main thing too, like being able to kind of just use some special power to
but it was not but it's
reality.
Not remember it's not a power, it's these tools that they had to build and they had to
use
sorry, all
that's,
of these
that's what I
yeah but it's yeah. like these building all of these instruments which a require like, you know, technology, you got to build stuff up to do it, and then they do these big things. Like, clearly they were
I'm not trying to argue that in the lore they are superpowers compared to other races. My point is more like, you can see how people get the impression that they are because they have all this.
I think it's just because they underestimate what the changes of magic would do in a world.
Either way,
and also because
like,
in
back
Skyrim,
to them,
they ripped out the tongues and all this.
Yeah.
Plus, but back to the reason we talked about the Dwemer of them potentially being an offshoot of the Kaima. I mean, my thinking was, which, you know, may or may not be true, because there's a lot of time between when the Kaima move over and when the Heart of Lorcan gets meddled with. But I kind of thought that perhaps Boethia and the Good Daedra wanted to send Lorcan, I mean, this goes back to that theory, but wanted to send Lorcan's protectors there to preempt the possibility that the Dwemer were going to meddle with the Heart of Lorcan. But that's, as with all things Dwemer and their origins, it's, you know, wild speculation.
Mm. Yeah,
at best.
Yeah, it's just one to consider. Like, you know, once again, they wouldn't need to team up with the Kaima to fight off the Nords if they could just stomp over all of them. And they didn't get any access to any godlike powers until they made the Alliance of the First Council, and then the Heart of Lorcan and stuff was being used to try and make the Numidium, which they also deleted themselves with, so they can't be that smart.
Control, alt, delete.
But at the same, it's also interesting, you know, everything happens with like a, you know, the effects of lore. Like, you can't, it's the same with like the Falmer, the Snow Elves. Like, what was it like for them interacting with the Kaima next door, the Velothi, and you know, clearly see it as a heretical. There's probably tensions there. Like, you've got this Auriel sort of focused, you know, Adric faith believing elves right next door to the opposite. Because that's where also I can imagine the Dwemer come from, the Chimer, by having, you know, Chimer are inherently heretical. Then you can have like similar veins of thought, like, you know, Sotha Sil and the Telvanni, kind of their philosophy and thought is very similar to the Dwemer. Like, so you can imagine them coming from the same source or the same people. Could just be a possibly a much earlier divergence, you know what I mean? But
yeah. This is a little bit unrelated, but if we're speaking about superpowered things, you could apply the same logic to the Dark Elves when you have the Tribunal in power. Like, why didn't they just take over much more land?
Well, they just weren't interested. And also, they need to be... They're tethered somewhat to the heart of Lorcan. They need to go back and so on.
And you do see bits and pieces, like, obviously, accepting the shellbacks and stuff. You've got, what, Vivek summoning a tidal wave to stop an invasion and things like this. So they definitely flex their muscles occasionally.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
But yeah, it's all insane. But so Dark Elves, not a Dwemer podcast. But the Dwemer and Chimer and Dunmer sort of, it's one package, you know, you can't really talk about one without bringing
it. But we've got to, you know, just like New Skyrim, we've got to reel it back in, you know, as if we're fishing.
Yeah. And some creation club.
But yeah. I would also say another thing that makes the Dunmer more so unique than other places is two things. And I'll say the easiest one first is that they... Until the start of the third era, they weren't conquered by any other force. You know, everywhere else had basically, I think except Somerset, but they'd kind of been like gave tribute to the Riemann Empire. But the Riemann Empire sort of functionally got everywhere except Morrowind. But it wasn't until the time of Tiber Septim. So that just, and even when it was, Tiber Septim did come in, they still got lots of autonomy comparatively to other places. So they really have been able to thrive as this sort of consistent, long-standing culture.
And as we touched on before, part of the reason Tiber Septim had any success at all is because it was an awkward time where Dagoth Ur was re-emerging and kind of causing their powers to wane a little bit. So... You know, the Empire definitely had a slightly better outcome because of that when dealing and creating the armistice.
Yeah. And the other part, too, is obviously its environment. Morrowind has a unique environment, unique fauna and flora that you don't see anywhere else. You could also argue that back in the day, in earlier kinds of lore, you could probably imagine that there were some mushrooms and stuff in the jungles of Cyrodiil next door. And there were, like, it wasn't just this, like, most of Tamriel would have been more envisioned as a sort of like crazier biome, like a little bit of extra juice, but I feel like they just didn't go with it. But we also haven't, you know, we know there's mushrooms and stuff all on the mainland and stuff because of ESO. And I mean, if you're into Tamriel Rebuilt, the mod, that's the mod, like it envisions it in a similar-ish way, but it gets a little bit different. But anyway, you got all of your big mushrooms. You've got things like netches, which are basically floating jellyfish. You've got the quama, which are these little tiny slug creatures that turn into these larger armored creatures. And that is one thing I think is what's really cool about the world building is, for example, it's like you're in this sort of ash ridden land, like, and only the south really is any good for any farms, or maybe the grazelands in the east. But how do you get around that? Well, they use these creatures called quama, which make eggs. They're like basically insects that create these eggs, which they then eat and use as a source of nutrition. So they have these big mines where they have a queen and they basically just mine her eggs and eat them as a source of food. So I love when people use world building to get around problems that might otherwise exist. So you have a cool society that can live in ashlands and stuff like that, you know? And you also have things like, you know, they don't have horses. They have silt striders that, big tick looking creatures that take you around.
It's just like a big flea.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny when you cross the mountains, the Velofi mountains, and you go from all of these unusual creatures and all this crazy flora and fauna to, you know, snowberries and wolves and bears and normal horses. But it's like, you know, Morrowind is the most Padamaic corner of Tamriel. And it seems to emanate from the heart of Lorcan.
I feel like if it was like as Cyrodiil was described in Morrowind, when you talk to people like Endless Jungle and so on, if you're looking at the map, if you had going from Vardenfell down to Blackmarsh and sort of in somewhat to Cyrodiil, the crazier kind of fauna and flora, it would make sense. Whereas where if you've got Skyrim with like huge mountain ranges, you can have some pretty different biomes and stuff that get divided by a natural barrier, especially if it's a frozen wasteland.
And plus, to be fair, obviously Skyrim was is described in much less generic terms before we actually saw it. And I, you know, that's not a criticism of Skyrim. It's just, you know, it was much more fantastical when you hear from Nords in Morrowind. Yeah.
But Dunmer, as it is, you can even see when you go and look at the architecture in ESO, in the mainland Morrowind architecture, it even differs a bit to Vardenfell. Vardenfell is also like the most spicy alien sort of area, I would say. And a lot of the, you know, the architecture is a bit different. But yeah.
I was going to say, even riding a Gwar is just so different.
Yeah.
To riding a horse.
Yeah.
But I mean, they are meant to be, I believe, more intelligent and have better endurance. You know, like they may not have the kind of imagery of a strong horse that you'd imagine in your head taking you around, but you might actually prefer to pick a Gwar if you had the choice.
I don't have the particular source with me, but I know there's anecdotes. I think it's either in-game dialogue or something, but in regards to how the Dunmer look at horses like food, they really like horse meat and so on, which is strange to the Imperials. Like, but
you know, you could have, if you're playing Elder Scrolls Online, you'd have a pick of many Gwars. You could have a Shadow Ghost Gwar.
Okay.
Or a Sidgic Mascot Gwar.
Yeah.
Which I'm not the biggest fan of, but
I wonder what Gwar meat tastes like.
Gwars in general are cool though.
I was thinking it's actually quite hard to talk about the Dunmer in such a cohesive sort of way, just because there is a lot of changes. Like, it's like, what is Dunmer culture exactly? But I guess there are, like,
How I felt when we were planning the podcast. It's like, okay guys, it's gonna be Dunmer, but like, we'll just skim over X, Y, and Z. I'm like,
look, we might need extra podcast episodes to dive in on specifics of certain areas, so if we miss bits and pieces to talk about here, you know, don't murder us in the comments. But if we were moving forward, so you've got basically the golden age of the Tribunal, which arguably starts from about the first era, year 700, throughout the sort of 2000 or so extra years of the first era. Then you've got the second era. They go off pretty well until the end of it, when Tiber Septim comes in. Dagothar severs their connection to the Heart of Lorcan. Either they get one of the tools. They can't restore their power anymore. They sign the armistice. They give Tiber Septim the pieces of the Numidium and so on. And society is preserved, but it's a little bit gimped, if you were to ask a Dunmer, because, you know, the Imperials have introduced, you know, forts everywhere all throughout their land. There's obviously, there is a trade, the East Empire Trading Company gets a hold on basically all of the sources of ebony and Dwemer artifacts and so on, and controls all of that export and trade. So there is actually ends up being a little bit of a black market trying to like sell it out to other countries. But also one of the big things is that they installed essentially a puppet government. You sort of have this kind of, you know, such with the Duke of Mournhold, and you basically end up having a king. So the first queen that was ever there was Baron Zaya, who was introduced as, she's got a whole connection with Tiber Septim, and they were supposedly lovers at one point, and he forced her to get an abortion, basically, and all of this kind of stuff. But basically, she was queen at first of Morrowind, but then that changed a bit later. I forgot who it goes to and so on, but it ends up going to her son or grandson, I've forgotten, King Helseth. But King Helseth essentially is a puppet of the Imperial interest, right? There's this kind of monarchy that's been established, and also series of nobility, because you have, like, you know, Duke of Ebonheart and stuff like that. And a lot of those, the other thing too, which the other great houses are not happy with, is that a lot of these nobles are House Hlaalu related, the Duke of and so that's because Hlaalu sort of benefited most by sort of going along with the Empire, and a lot of the other houses hate them for that,
which is a bold move from the beginning. Because, you know there's a lot of anti-imperial sentiment, and if the Imperials stop having an influence, which may happen, then you're a bit screwed.
It does fit into the sphere of betrayal though a little bit, doesn't it? But I mean, not really allying yourself with your own people is pretty big betrayal for a Dunmer, you know, being one of the most nationalistic and xenophobic societies around. And I mean, it wouldn't help that they got all of this preferential treatment. You know, they were gifted the lion's share of the best lands in the Fertile Ascadian Isles, the charter to the rich ebony mines in Caldera, all kinds of things. And as Scott was saying, leadership positions.
Yeah.
Very unfair.
Well, that's the thing. It's like his name, sorry, just to clarify, it was Baranzai's son is Hlalu Helseth, King Helseth. You know, he's a House Hlalu too. So it's just, you know, they could, you can see that being sat there is to basically somewhat challenge the tribunal's sort of hold and also the Great House's hold on things as well. And we also know that Helseth abolishes slavery. We hear that from rumors in Oblivion. So he even basically reduced the sort of traditional rights of the houses, which they were absolutely pissed with, to be frank. And but all of this doesn't matter soon, because what happens is we have Bardal crashes down into, without Vivek's power, crashes down into Vivek, causes a sort of earthquake kind of thing, and Red Mountain
just explodes. Quickly before that, so, as well, with House Hlalu is when the Oblivion Crisis happens, obviously, remember, the Imperials just bugger off and leave Morrowind on their own.
Yeah.
So Hlalu were probably a little bit scared leading up to the Cataclysm as
and
well. But yeah,
and
sorry.
Also before double cut in, they probably wouldn't have gotten rid of slavery anyway, if you think about it. Like, I'm sure it would have been a very like surface level law. And I mean, consider too that a lot of the houses couldn't necessarily be controlled. Like, you're going to have a hard time going to House Telvanni and being like, no more slaves.
But I think my only thing in an alternate history experiment, the only thing is that they can't their power really is, you know, secured by the gods. If the gods are gone, they could theoretically
But House Telvanni are kind of low-key gods anyway, when you look at how powerful...
Yeah, but...
what I'm saying is, I don't think that, you know, legal enforcers would trek it out en masse enough needed to fight against Telvanni mages to be like, no, get rid of these cages with a few, you know,
but at the same time, whatever Telvanni, like, look, arguably lots of the Telvanni would be removed, but obviously there's some that are as powerful as like Daivaith Fear kind of level, although he is the most powerful among the Telvanni, but they could sit on a tower by themselves and they're not worth it or whatever. But if they're like,
I suppose it's just my in my head canon, at least, just using deduction, I would assume that as much as they would have gotten rid of it and that could have a big impact, I personally believe it would be hard to enforce somewhat.
And either way, like, just generally speaking, no matter how well it's implemented, they're straying just further and further away from the initial foundational ideas that kind of created their race to begin with, you know. And coming back to the crash of Bardal into Vivek City, which triggers the eruption of Red Mountain in the year 5 of the Fourth Era. It's like, this is kind of like the end point of their downfall, their gradual downfall that was promised after, you know, and then the Nerevarine prophecy happens, and now this, and then the Argonians thrust up from Black Marsh and take a load of Morrowind by storm. And they're, you know, they're about as far down as they could possibly be. It's time
add on to,
for a comeback.
To bring it to House Hlalu, like we were just talking about, it's noted in Ravenrock, in the missions in there, that House Hlalu was specifically targeted after the Empire, after the whole Red Mountain Empire thing. They basically got absolutely wrecked, and House Sadras became sort of the other great house to step up. But it's kind of weird to sort of imagine what modern Morrowind looks like. We know they have Solstheim as well, but House Redoran are said to be the ones in power now, in the major political power. They're the ones who came to fight off the Argonian invasion and stop them in their tracks. And the new capital is no longer Mournhold, but Blacklight, which is the sort of capital of House Redoran, which is interesting.
Because, Scott, I think you've talked about this a fair bit before in a couple of videos, but having 200 years in the Fourth Era kind of makes the timeline a little bit awkward, because you've got Red Mountain erupting and the Cataclysm and everything that follows, and you've got this wave of Dunmer refugees and you've got the province in general is in turmoil. And there are, I can't remember the exact source, but essentially there's a source coming out of Almalexia, the capital city of Mournhold. Basically, this is 100 to 200 years later, saying that we're starting to rebuild. And it's like, wait, really? Like, it's so bad that you can't even, you know, your capital city is still in ruins almost 200 years later.
They got too cushy with the tribunal.
Yeah.
They haven't gone through enough hardship.
It's funny because I think it's the assumption would be that there is that. Remember, there's that character, Branshay in the Dark Elf, who was raised by Argonians, and you go do his little mission, you read the book that he's supposedly the last member of House Telvanni, and we know that not to be true when you go and find Neloth and Ravenrock. However, at the same time, and I think he alludes to some holdings, but you can easily imagine that House Telvanni gets massively diminished by along with a lot of the other houses, but especially just because in times of crisis you've got the Telvanni, which are just such self-serving basically wizard lords, as opposed to other sort of more politically, culturally minded groups that might be able to band together, like Redoran or so on. The other one to mention is House Dress also got massively hit by the Argonians. Like, a lot of their lands are to the south, close to Blackmarsh. They got absolutely swamped. They're still around, I think, but, you know, for very different circumstances. It's kind of hard to imagine that slavery is still going on, just almost because they can't exert it over it, maybe.
Yeah, you need much more power to be able to have that kind of
probably not in their best interest at the time. Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
they've got stuff. And so the last house to mention that's of significant change is that House Indoril basically just became the new temple. Like, they basically merged almost. They're like indistinguishable. So basically the new tribunal temple, which is all centered around the reclamations. And like I was mentioning before, how you had the good Daedra positioned as the anticipations of the tribunal. Instead, post the Nerevarine prophecy and the cataclysm and so on, they have been relegated to the role of saints, and the good Daedra have returned as what they call the reclamations, reclaiming their rightful place as the tribunal.
So they're a bit wishy-washy. They're kind of like a bit of a sellout house religiously, right? Wouldn't it be rather heretical to be saying basically what they believe now during the time of the tribunal?
Oh, like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like, but it's based on revelation. I guess it's the same thing as, like, you know, probably the coming of Jesus had heretical elements to the normal doctrines or whatnot, or anything.
Except, you know. I think specifically with the tribunal, I know they entered a golden age with the tribunal, but they really were... they were a curse on the Khymer people, and even though it was delayed onset, they ruined this race. And really, the only redemption, I think, for the Dunmer is to essentially go back to their roots and to become the Khymer again, even if they're never forgiven enough to restore their golden skin. They essentially need to re-embrace Hyvelothi culture, like, operate their society based on the teachings of the reclamations, the good Daedra, and repent for ever worshipping the tribunal. I think that's all they can do.
Could you not say, like, Hyvelothi culture fell before and started going down into, like, just like fighting Ashlander type clans before they accepted the tribunal? Like, the tribunal didn't come around to later. So what I'm sort of,
I suppose it depends on
that,
your definition of success, right? Because you can look at orcs and they're always, you know, fighting amongst each other and living simple lives, and you can say that's,
it's like a philosophical success.
Yeah,
it's like a practice of your values.
And even then, I wouldn't say that having house culture goes against the good Daedra. It's purely, you know, usurping them. It was them being usurped that caused the downfall. So,
but I just, like, from a, if we're non-using philosophical points, the Morrowind was far better off with the tribunal in terms of, like, just infrastructure.
But there was there was the promise that it was always going to be temporary. They were never going to thrive forever.
It's like taking a bite from say the about forbidden any fruit. Empire. And it tastes good, and then bad stuff
I guess it's
happens
just it's
you.
Just kind of when it's like over 2,000, 3,000, what are they, like 3,000, over 3,000 years of golden age. Sounds like a pretty sweet gig for, like, eventual cataclysm. Like, most societies don't even last. You know, the Roman Empire lasted, like, you know, five.
We can't use timelines when it comes to the Elder Scrolls.
Is a bit like eating the forbidden fruit, having immortality and a sick life for 3,000 years, and then, oops,
like
punishment
I
on the end.
I agree they got their comeuppance and it's a return to the reclamations is more so a return to their original purpose. But like I don't know if it's like it ruined the, like it gave the Dunmer people a sweet gig, honestly, for most of their life. Like I would say, and you know, lots of things can be like that, you know, like, you know, it gives you benefits, but then forego philosophical
thing I would say then is that rather than, you know, I'd rather than kind of treating the tribunal as Jesus in the sense that they were the kind of the natural follow-on, but consider them more like they decided they're better than the gods is essentially the way to look at it, as opposed to them being like, oh, you know, the Anticipations is kind of a cover-up for the fact that they just want to be in control.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And like it's a lot easier to tell a population like, hey, your gods are real. They're just like these saints, or, and you know,
and they chose us,
and we're the real gods. It's a lot easier to cop that than, oh, they're not real at all, and we're your new real gods, and well, just us.
You can absolutely imagine. I actually mentioned this in the ideal Skyrim, where a reimagining of Skyrim was that there would be plenty of people who are still, like, you know, dogmatically loyal to the tribunal and like saying, oh, they're not dead, then, you know, they're probably coming back. The return of the tribunal, we've just got to have faith. Because if you look at a lot of the scriptures and stuff that are in the game, it's all this weird Stockholm kind of syndrome. It's like faith powers us. Faith keeps everything from dying. So they've got this really big idea of belief. So perhaps, you know, and if it has been 200 years in the actual timeline, then it's more reasonable to say that that's kind of gone and petered out, you know, because a lot of the elves would be dead from that time.
Now the Ashlanders get all the respect.
Yeah.
And people go do pilgrimages to them.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is, you can, you know, me especially, say all these nice things about the good Daedra, but really, the Ashlanders should have been they should have been protected from the curse. They should never have turned into Dunmer, almost like as a reward for their loyalty. You know, but instead they were punished just as much. And
we know Azura.
And as so there you go. Nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
Probably the best god though to punish you, right? Like if you had to pick.
Whoa. Oh yeah. Exactly.
No. Like if you had to pick from those three, who were going to put a curse on your people, who would you choose? Probably Azura, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, your skin goes blue. Dark gray, blue.
Gray, yeah.
You know, I played Oblivion as my first game. Yeah. I can't get rid of the blueberry.
The blueberry
the
voice.
The blueberry voice. But, you know.
Yeah, look, well, I've seen what Boethia does to sacrifices.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not my cup of tea.
Well, that's kind of the thing. It's like, their entire, like, the whole Triangle Truth philosophy of, like, seeing, you know, mortality as a challenge to overcome and seek enlightenment is kind of, it's a really, like, rough path. Like, it means life's going to be horrible and hard and everything like that. And I was even in the Vivek video, the Vivek Explained, I was sort of talking about how, in a way, Vivek accomplished it, and he even sort of achieving Kim and so on was him fulfilling the Triangle Truth and doing that kind of thing. But, and you know, he did horrible things like conspired to murder his best friend and all of this kind of stuff to get there. And then he gets to the enlightenment and so on. But at the same time, the bounty that he sort of fought to get and so on, that he shares with everyone else, kind of robs them of their ability to strive, because the gods, the tribunal living gods, brought about a softer time, an easier time for everyone. So, I mean, they've had their fair share of challenges. Like, this is still like some medieval magic crazy world. Like, there's still stuff going on, you know. You know, Mournhold got destroyed by Meereen's Dagon at one point, and then they came in to stop him. But, like, you know, plenty of people still died.
What does Dagon have against Morrowind?
I don't know if... he was just answering the call of a witch who was wronged by the...
Oh, do we? Yeah, that's from the last year of the First Era.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that a fictional text?
It's a fictional text about historical things. So it's a retelling of it. So it would be like us watching, like, you know, the movie Troy or something. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
it's kind of
that's how it feels. Well, sorry, actually, that's even wrong, because that's technically, you know, historical mythological kind of thing. Like, it's probably, you know, any other movie, a King Arthur movie or something, like the one with Clive Owen and stuff. It tries to be a historical King Arthur kind of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's historical fiction.
Yeah, historical fiction. But Sorry, I had somewhere to go because there was something else we've missing and we haven't brought up yet about their.
I mean, there's a lot of things. Society. There's a lot of topics to talk about.
So since we're at there, this is probably a good spot to speak about it because we're at the Good Daedra, and that was basically a return to Monkey, return to the primal religions of the Good Daedra, Mephala Boethia, and Azura. You also have the opposite of that, which they call the four corners of the House of Troubles, because you know how they use like house imagery and that kind of stuff, and you know there's the houses and there's a literal house with four corners, and that House of Troubles contains Sheogorath, the Prince of Madness, who tries and basically makes them crazy or tempt them away and like basically screw them up mentally. Basically, that's his job. You've got Mehrunes Dagon, who he represents the challenges such as physical adversity of the land that they're on, destruction, yada, yada, yada. You've got Malakath, who represents another physical test, but in the forms of the orcs, and who's trying to fight. And also, he's House of Troubles because he is the corrupted version of Trinimac, who was one of their oldest antagonists. And then you've got Molag Bal, who tries to corrupt the purity of their bloodlines in their families and clans, of which they hold so dear. But these four Daedra are picked out as really bad Daedra from the Dunmer's perspective, because they all sort of fight against their values, I guess.
Did you mention Sheogorath, or did I?
Yeah, no.
Lord of Cringe.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that. I love
I'll
that
have
picture.
To show that meme up because I felt so heard about that one. That was so good. How I feel about him so often.
He felt listened to.
Yeah, I'll put that up. I don't think it was directed to me. I just came across it by chance. It was on the Twitter feed, but So you've got the House of Troubles, and they form like your sort of most antagonistic gods of the Dunmer people, and the Daedra all somewhat play a role. Like, they're not completely unaware of other Daedra and so on. You'll find Daedric shrines to other people throughout. Like, you'll have, you know, I guess it's come down to heretics. Like, all Daedra, it's kind of interesting because it's hard. You've got to interpret a little bit, but some of the older Chimer understanding kind of seems that there's these good Daedra and then there's the four really bad Daedra, but the ones in between kind of could be used at certain times, or there were certain cults or something to it. Obviously, all of it becomes bad underneath the tribunal, and they're like, no, that's all crook. But, you know, it's kind of interesting there.
And the House of Troubles do have, you know, as you pretty much said, they do have shrines. So even though they're considered the bad ones, there are reminders of them everywhere.
Because
it's a good thing to have those adversities without them.
Well,
there's kind of nothing to step on as you find the truth.
Exactly. It's like it's the essential embodiments of all of the resistance that they're going to find within the challenges to sort of ascend. You know what I mean? Like, if there's no chaotic sort of stuff being thrown at you, you can't adapt and change. You know, it's kind of like you could think of it almost like a spiritual natural selection or sort of evolution. You know what I mean? They're just, you want natural evolutionary pressures on you so that you can evolve as a person. Whereas if a society that grows fat and weak, like the tribunal did towards the end of the Golden Age, you know, it quickly can collapse, as is with a lot of civilizations, you know, the peak bread and circuses kind of thing, and they can fall apart.
Getting a bit ominous.
Yeah. But yeah. So, where to next? Because Fourth Era, because there's not a lot to say about Fourth Era Morrowind other than it's pretty grim, honestly. And we don't have a lot of, like, primary information. Like, I think, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to say where to go into more detail.
Because it's like, but we can kind of, like, oh, you go into architecture and it's like, yeah, look, it's all like different kind of stuff. I do like at least how the houses, especially, you know, obviously the difference between Telvanni, with their growing their own mushroom towers with their powerful magics. You've got the Hlalu, which are a little bit more conventional. They kind of look like adobe sort of structures, you know, a bit like Moroccan or Middle Eastern kind of structures.
Yeah, it's a lot more cosmopolitan and kind of like structured and ordered, and, you know, it's similar to their relationship with the Empire in that it's, you know, it's very, I'm struggling for the right words, but yeah, simple and not over the top and crazy.
If guys listening want to get blown away, I think is just look into Tamriel Rebuilt and get it, because I think they really, really do justice for House Indoril specifically, and fleshing out all of the different houses and their lands and so on that make them feel much more.
Their interpretation of Mournhold, even though most of the doors don't lead anywhere yet, is like the nicest, the coolest looking, and potentially the biggest city I've ever seen in an Elder Scrolls game.
They definitely lean into more like Chinese sort of architecture, like kind of big pagoda kind of towers and styles. But it actually looks reasonably similar to, because obviously it was all built off just the Tribunal DLC, so they were inspired by that little area you get to go. But if you look at like the Morrowind architecture in ESO, it's similar enough. They use a lot more like brick and make it look plain. It's not fantastic, but you know.
Tamriel rebuilt. Sorry, you go.
Oh, well, I was going to say, I don't want to get this wrong, but I specifically remember there was a, when I was writing the video on Mournhold, I think it was Lawrence Schick, who was the lore master at the time, talked about how the reason Mournhold was so boring looking in The Elder Scrolls Online was because when Tiber Septim came along, Almalexia anticipated that he was going to visit, so she spent a load of money to make the city look much nicer. So the Mournhold we see later that's got like these extra rings of city around it came conveniently a few hundred years after the events of The Elder Scrolls Online.
Man.
I will fact check that to make sure I'm not slandering anyone.
Mournhold
looks
pretty like, it looks like a village with a big temple in the middle of it in ESO.
The
like,
temple in Morrowind is so cool.
Yeah, and I obviously all of the city around it was in the Tamriel rebuilt stuff was additionally added. But like the idea that this is what Mournhold looks like to even like match, I don't know, to be nice and pretty for the Empire is ridiculous. This looks awful. And then also, these are basically like someone, you know, egoist cult of personality sort of places. It's a city named after herself. Do you think she's going to let it look like dog shit? Like, no. It's going to be this giant grand city of you know, epicness and grandeur because it's a city of the god, you know? You don't just... Mm-hmm. This is kind of... I'm just like, oh...
So just to get it completely right, the exact verbatim quote is, early Mournhold was largely destroyed by Maerun's Dagon at the end of the First Era. The city you see in ESO has been gradually rebuilt from that time. After the Interregnum, Almalexia commissions and has built the greater city you see in Tribunal, partly as a reaction to the rise of Tiber Septim. So, yeah. Blame that damn Dagon for making the game a bit boring.
Yeah, because the Morrowind architecture, like Elder Scrolls 3 Morrowind, is just so much better in a lot of areas, and then you can really feel the influence that they pulled in from all kinds of different cultures being there a lot stronger. I know you said there are parts of Chinese architecture and stuff in Tamriel rebuilt, and obviously in Morrowind little bits of it, but all kinds of things, like from Indian stuff to Thai stuff, like
Mesopotamian sort of stuff.
Just all kinds of stuff blended together into such a unique you know, thing.
That, one thing too is like, it's kind of hard to even say, like, you know, there's plenty of like little African things or Mongol things thrown in the, you know, with the Ashlanders too, and you can't, it's kind of hard to just list everything that is to do with the Dunmer, because so much of it's in the experience of just the little details everywhere. Even just when they've like got like, oh, here's like, these are things called foyardas, these big lava river systems that we basically, you know, use, and or you know, even their language with the sort of like old Sotha or old this, and they've got like their own language to help flesh it out. But all of these little small details can't really be, well, you can list them off if you can think of them, but it's hard to sort of,
there's just like little things like a rice paper looking partition somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, you know,
and even with their like you know, like Vivek's mythology and philosophy can be drawn from so many different Eastern religions and spiritual beliefs and things like that.
And even Western religions too, like sort of, I mean, it's probably more broadly applies to the Elder Scrolls, but Gnosticism and stuff. Gnosticism. I always
Gnostic,
like Gnostic and in,
Gnosticism.
Gnosticism. Right. Yeah.
I think.
Is that what I said?
It looks like the C is hard there because if you take
anyway,
off the ism,
so the whole idea of having this sort of evil god that created the material world of flesh and everything that you're kind of trying to get out is kind of like the, you know, the central premise for Lorcan and so on, and the different views of it. There's so many cool bits and pieces all over the place. But yeah, like we talked about Ghost Fence. Like, I mean, they eat salt rice. Like, you know, there's, I don't know, it's kind of hard to...
I mean, if you're interested in more of this kind of stuff, listeners, check out Skyrim, Who Are the Dunmer Really? Elder Scrolls Lore and Mythology. We have a video all about it on the channel.
Yeah.
Which actually covers in specific, not just architecture, but all kinds of things involving gods and inspiration for certain characters.
Plus, I'm sure if you wrote Fudge Muppet Dunmer, there's probably about 5 pages of videos that are somewhat related to
that. The other thing too, which I think is somewhat what kind of gives Morrowind a lot more flavor, is that it takes big inspirations from sci-fi stuff and like you know, like Dune and Star Wars, or you know, Dark Crystal. Like, it takes a lot of that. If you go on, you want a Morrowind flavored movie, go look at like the Jim Henson sort of Dark Crystal movie, or even the new series that they made off it. It's all that kind of weird architecture and big bug creatures and, you know, chitin armor and stuff like that. Even bone mold as a concept is pretty cool. Like, there's lots of unique bits and pieces to love. It's just, man, it's just so cool that they stand out so much. And it's kind of sad that they do stand out so much in a way, because it means that the rest of the Tamriel is a little bit more plain as regard. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I think Dunmer society is the one that doesn't fix into a box. Like, you know, you go, oh, Vikings, or you go like, oh, Moors for Red Guards, or you go, oh, Romans for Imperials. And they used to have, and there's little bits and pieces everywhere and flavors, but Argonians, you're just kind of like, oh, you know, Mesoamerican. But with, you can't really just pin one to the Dunmer, because it's a very strong mix.
I think it's nice. Really good that Morrowind was made when it was made.
Mm-hmm.
Because imagine if Skyrim was made when Morrowind was instead, and had way more of the stuff that was talked about in the lore back then there present. And then Morrowind comes out and it does not live up to it. It's a much,
it's a little bit of a Wild West, and it was just so inspired and it was, you know, very original. And yeah, the fact it came out when it did allowed for that to happen. And at the end of the day, it's like, it doesn't matter who your favorite race is, it's hard not to just accept the fact that Dunmer are the best race in the Elder Scrolls. Yeah. Just like, you can't deny it, even if you prefer a different race.
The coolest.
Yeah, because they're just, their land, the attention given to them is just so, it's so special.
Suppose that may bring us to the end of the Dunmer podcast.
I guess so, because we will do ones later on the Tribunal and stuff. Mm-hmm. Talk about them more.
All right.
It's just, yeah.
Well, thank you everyone for watching. Social media links are in the description, and we look forward to nerding out with you again next time.